Hi there, welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast, and as promised, this is the first installment of my read aloud of my novel Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. As I mentioned last week, I realized that this book has turned 10 years old, and it got me thinking about maybe writing a sequel or a prequel or a something. I actually have something in mind that I'm not going to talk about quite yet, but on the way to fleshing that idea out, I'm going to be reading this book aloud. I've read it into my podcast before, but never with a pen in my hand, never making notes literally on the edges of the book here. That's what I did with Homeland. I took a copy of Little Brother and read it and made notes and dog ears all the way through of things that I wanted to pay attention to in Homeland. I have that copy here. I keep thinking I should donate it to a charity auction or something, but maybe I'll hang on to it for a few years and see how Homeland does, and maybe if it does particularly spectacularly, it will be worth more to a charity. It's been a kind of stressy week at home. It shouldn't have been. My wife is back triumphant from South by Southwest, where her company, Makey Lab, won the incubator, South by Southwest Incubator Prize. But we're now a two-parent family, but both of us still jet-lagged and quite tired. And then to top it all off, yesterday my daughter, we were inaugurated into the wonders of having an older child who gets sick in the night. When she was a toddler, of course, she would sometimes wake up and puke or cry or have a cold that would keep her from sleeping. But last night she crawled into bed with us, or actually just with me. My wife was up with jet lag and then puked all over the bed and then puked all over her bed and then puked all over every towel in the house, and then all over every pillow in the house and every pair of pajamas she owned and the sofa. And, well, you get the picture. She was in much better sorts this morning. It seems to have been a kind of overnight bug. She had like a degree of fever, and I'm guessing it's just either a mild bout of food poisoning or a mild bout of some kind of tummy bug. I used to get them all the time when I was a kid, and my wife tells me she never got them, so I guess maybe the kid inherited this for me. But she, as I say, was in pretty good sorts this morning. I was at home for most of the morning waiting for an emergency sitter to come by. And so this podcast may not go out until Tuesday, because I'm going to be getting it to John Taylor Williams, the editor, very late today. This coming Saturday, if you happen to be in London, I hope you'll come down to Forbidden Planet for the launch of the British edition of Rapture of the Nerds, the book that came out last autumn that I wrote with Charlie Stross. Came out last autumn in the United States, that is. There was a bit of a switch with my British publisher. I'm now with an amazing new British publisher, Titan Books, and Titan is bringing out that and Pirate Cinema and also Homeland. Pirate Cinema, we will launch very shortly at the EasterCon, the National Science Fiction Convention in Bradford. I'll be doing lots of other British events as well. I'll be at Hay on Wye for the How the Light Gets In Festival. I'll be in Shetland. I'm just doing a ton of UK events in the remainder of this year. So I hope to see you at some or all of those. And I'll be doing them in Scotland, in England, in the North, in the South, in Wales, and so on. So please, if you're around, come on out and say hi and show Titan some love. I'm very grateful to them for being my British publisher. And again, that's this coming Saturday at Forbidden Planet at 1 o'clock, and then a week this Saturday at EasterCon in Bradford. Please do come out. So that's it. And the only other thing I have to say, I guess, is let the story begin. I'm going to read to you now from Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow, published February 3rd, 2003, by Tor Books. Prologue. I lived long enough to see the cure for death, to see the rise of the Bitchin Society, to learn 10 languages, to compose 3 symphonies, to realize my boyhood dream of taking up residence in Disney World, to see the death of the workplace and of work. But I never thought that I'd live to see the day when Keep a Movin' Dan would decide to deadhead until the heat death of the universe. Dan was in his second or third blush of youth when I first met him, sometime late 21st. He was a rangy cowpoke, apparent 25 or so, all rawhide squint lines and sunburned neck, boots worn thin and infinitely comfortable. I was in the middle of my chem thesis, my fourth doctorate, and he was taking a break from saving the world, chilling on campus in Toronto and core dumping for some poor anthro major. We hooked up at the Grad Students Union, the GSU, or Gazoo for those who knew. On a busy Friday night, springish, I was fighting a choral slow battle for a stool at the scratched bar, inching my way closer every time the press of bodies shifted. And he had one of the few seats surrounded by a litter of cigarette junk and empties, clearly encamped. Some duration into my foray, he cocked his head at me and raised a sun-bleached eyebrow. "You get any closer, son, and we're going to have to get a prenup." I was a parent 40 or so, and I thought about bridling at being called son, but I looked into his eyes and decided that he had enough real time, that he could call me son any time he wanted. I backed off a little and apologized. He struck a cig and blew a pungent, strong plume over the bartender's head. "Don't worry about it. I'm probably a little over-accustomed to personal space." I couldn't remember the last time I'd heard anyone on World talk about personal space. With the mortality rate at zero, and the birth rate at non-zero, the world was inexorably accreting a dense carpet of people, even with the migratory and deadhead drains on the population. "You've been jaunting?" I asked. His eyes were too sharp for him to have missed an instant's experience to deadheading. He chuckled. "No, sir, not me. I'm into the kind of macho shitheadery that you only come across on World. Jaunting's for play. I need work." The bar glass tinkled a counterpoint. I took a moment to conjure a HUD with his woofy score on it. I had to resize the window. He had too many zeros on it to fit in my standard display. I tried to act cool, but he caught the upward flick of my eyes and their involuntary widening. He tried a little, "aw, shucksery," but he gave it up and let a prideful grin show. I try not to pay it much mind. Some people, they get overly grateful. He must have seen my eyes flick up again to pull his woofy history. "Wait, don't go doing that. I'll tell you about it. You really got to know. Damn, you know, it's so easy to get used to life without hyperlinks. You think you'd really miss him, but you don't." And it clicked for me. He was a missionary, one of those fringe dwellers who act as emissary from the bitchin' society to the benighted corners of the world where, for whatever reason, they want to die, starve, and choke on petrochem waste. It's amazing that these communities survive more than a generation. In the bitchin' society proper, we usually outlive our detractors. The missionaries don't have such a high success rate. You have to be awfully convincing to get through to a culture that's already successfully resisted nearly a century's worth of propaganda. But when you convert a whole village, you accrue all the woofy that they have to give. More often, missionaries end up getting refreshed from a backup after they aren't heard of from a decade or so. I'd never met one in the flesh before. "How many successful missions have you had?" I asked. "Figured it out, huh? Well, I've just come off my fifth in 20 years. Counter-revolutionaries, hidden out in the old Cheyenne Mountain NORAD site. Still there a generation later." He sandpapered his whiskers with his fingertips. "Their parents went to ground after their life savings vanished, and they had no use for tech any more advanced than a rifle. Plenty of those, though." He spun a fascinating yarn then, of how he slowly gained the acceptance of the mountain dwellers, and then their trust, and then betrayed it in subtle, beneficent ways, introducing free energy to their greenhouses, then a gingineered crop or two, then curing a couple of deaths, slowly inching them toward the bitchin' society until they couldn't remember why they hadn't wanted to be a part of it from the start. Now they were mostly off-world, exploring toy frontiers with unlimited energy and unlimited supplies and deadheading through the dull times en route. I guess it'd be too much of a shock for them to stay on-world. They think of us as the enemy, you know. They had all kinds of plans drawn up for when we invaded them and took them away. Hollow suicide teeth, booby traps, fallback and rendezvous points for the survivors. They just can't get over hating us, even though we don't even know they exist. Off-world, they can still pretend they're living rough and hard. He rubbed his chin again, his hard calluses grating over his whiskers. But for me, the real rough life is right here, on-world. The little enclaves, each one is like an alternate history of humanity. What if we'd taken free energy, but not deadheading? What if we'd taken deadheading, but only for the critically ill and not for the people who don't want to be bored on long bus rides? or no hyperlinks, no adhocracy, no woofy. Each is different and wonderful. I have a stupid argument of arguing for the sake of, and I found myself saying, wonderful? Oh, sure, nothing finer than, oh, let's see, dying, starving, freezing, broiling, killing, cruelty and ignorance and pain and misery. I know, I sure miss it. Keep a moving, Dan snorted. You think a junkie misses sobriety? I knocked on the bar. Hello, there aren't any junkies anymore. He struck another cig. But you know what a junkie is, right? Junkies don't miss sobriety because they don't remember how sharp everything was, how the pain made the joy sweeter. We can't remember what it was like to work to earn our keep, to worry that there might not be enough, that we might get sick or get hit by a bus. We don't remember what it was like taking chances, and we sure as shit don't remember what it was like to have them pay off. He had a point. Here I was, only in my second or third adulthood, and already ready to toss it all in and do something, anything else. He had a point, but I wasn't about to admit it. So you say. I say, I take a chance when I strike up a conversation at a bar, when I fall in love, and what about the deadheads? Two people I know, they just went deadhead for 10,000 years. Tell me that's not taking a chance. Truth be told, almost everyone I'd known in my 80-some years were deadheading or jaunting or just gone. Lonely days, then. Brother, that's committing half-ass suicide. The way we're going, we'll be lucky if someone doesn't just switch him off when it comes time to reanimate. In case you haven't noticed, it's getting a little crowded around here. I made pish-tosh sounds and wiped off my forehead with a bar napkin. The gazoo was beastly hot on summer nights. Uh-huh. Just like the world was getting a little crowded 100 years ago before free energy. Like it was getting too greenhousey, too nuky, too hot, or too cold. We fixed it then, and we'll fix it again when the time comes. I'm going to be here in 10,000 years, you damn betcha, and I think I'll do it the long way around. He cocked his head again and gave it some thought. If it had been any of the other grad students, I'd have assumed he was grepping for some bolstering factoids to support his next sally. But with him, I just knew he was thinking about it, the old-fashioned way. I think that if I'm still here in 10,000 years, I'm going to be crazy as hell. 10,000 years, pal. 10,000 years ago, the state of the art was a goat. You really think you're going to be anything recognizably human in 100 centuries? Me, I'm not interested in being a post-person. I'm going to wake up one day and I'm going to say, well, I guess I've seen about enough. And that'll be my last day. I had seen where he was going with this, and I had stopped paying attention while I readied my response. I probably should have paid more attention. But why? Why not just deadhead for a few centuries, see if there's anything that takes your fancy, and if not, back to sleep for a few more? Why do anything so final? He embarrassed me by making a show of thinking it over again, making me feel like I was some half-pissed glib poltroon. I suppose it's because nothing else is. I've always known that someday I was going to stop moving, stop seeking, stop kicking, and have done with it. There'll come a day when I don't have anything left to do, except stop. On campus, they called him Keep a Movin' Dan because of his cowboy vibe and because of his lifestyle, and he somehow grew to take over every conversation I had for the next 6 months. I pinged his woofy a few times and noticed that it was climbing steadily upward as he accumulated more esteem from the people he met. I pretty much pissed away most of my woofy, all the savings from the symphonies and the first 3 theses, drinking myself stupid at the gazoo, hogging library terminals, pestering profs, until I'd expended all the respect anyone had ever afforded me. All except Dan, who, for some reason, stood me to regular beers and meals and movies. I got to feeling like I was someone special. Not everyone had a chum as exotic as Keep a Movin' Dan, the legendary missionary who visited the only places left that were closed to the bitchin' society. I can't say for sure why he hung around with me. He mentioned once or twice that he'd liked my symphonies and that he'd read my ergonomics thesis on applying theme park crowd control techniques in urban settings and liked what I had to say there. But I think it came down to us having a good time needling each other. I'd talk to him about the vast carpet of the future unrolling before us, the certainty that we would encounter alien intelligences someday, of the unimaginable frontiers open to each of us. He'd tell me that deadheading was a strong indicator that one's personal reservoir of introspection and creativity was dry, and that without struggle, there could be no real victory. This was a good fight, one that we could have 1,000 times without resolving. I'd get him to concede that Woofy recaptured the true essence of money. In the old days, if you were broke but respected, you wouldn't starve. Contrariwise, if you were rich and hated, no sum could buy you security and peace. By measuring the thing that money really represented, your personal capital with your friends and neighbors, you more accurately gauged your success. And then he'd lead me down a subtle, carefully baited trail that led to my allowing that while, yes, we might someday encounter alien species with wild and fabulous ways, that right now there was a slightly depressing homogeneity to the world. On a fine spring day, I defended my thesis to 2 embodied humans and 1 prof whose body was out for an overhaul, whose consciousness was present via speakerphone from the computer where it was resting. They all liked it. I collected my sheepskin and went out hunting for Dan in the sweet, flower-drinking streets. He'd gone. The anthromager he'd been torturing with his war stories said that he'd wrapped up that morning and that he'd headed to the walled city of Tijuana to take a shot with the descendants of the platoon of U.S. Marines who'd settled there and cut themselves off from the bitchin' society. So I went to Disney World. In deference to Dan, I took the flight in real time, in the minuscule cabin reserved for those of us who stubbornly refused to be frozen and stacked like cordwood for the 2-hour flight. I was the only one taking the trip in real time, but a flight attendant dutifully served me a urine sample-sized orange juice and a rubbery pungent cheese omelet. I stared out the window at the infinite clouds while the autopilot banked around the turbulence and wondered when I'd see Dan next. All right, well, that's the prologue. Next week, I'll start in on Chapter 1, maybe get all the way through it. Hope you have a great week. I hope you come out to Forbidden Planet. I hope my daughter stops throwing up. And I hope well, that's probably all that I hope for right now. All right, talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast. This recording is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. Or as Woody Guthrie once put it, this song is copyrighted in the U.S. under Seal of Copyright number 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without permission will be a mighty good friend of ours, because we don't give a darn. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's ryneckstudio@gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is an audiovisual and multimedia producer in Washington, D.C., and the co-host of the Living Proof Brewcast. Hear him wax poetic over a pint or two of beer by visiting hot.com/livingproofbrewcast.com. In his free time, he makes beer jewelry and odd musical furniture. He often meditates while reading cookbooks. Excelsior!